This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I step into a large room crammed with computers, maps, reference books and top experts whose only job is to give us the most thorough briefing possible on the big questions of the day. And our question today is religious intolerance on the rise? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. With the Chinese giant tech company Huawei in the news again, you might find our recent briefing on that company and its relationship with the Chinese government rather interesting. In Sri Lanka this week, people claiming to be acting out of religious belief killed hundreds of people, mostly of a different faith, in this case, Christians. Religious intolerance is a theme which has surfaced in the news with some frequency in recent years, be it the persecution of the Rohingya in Myanmar, the Yazidis in Iraq, the Uyghurs in China, and numerous blasphemy trials in Pakistan. Today, I want to know, insofar as I can, whether religious intolerance, intolerance of religions or by religions, is actually on the rise, and if so, who is leading this? Governments? Nationalist political movements? Or the faithful themselves? Step inside the briefing room and we'll try to find out. First, let's turn to Sri Lanka to find out more about the relationships between religions on the island, where the roots of extremism might be, and why the attack happened now. Earlier, I was joined in the briefing room by Alan Keenan, a senior analyst from the International Crisis Group, an independent NGO focused on resolving conflict. Alan Keenan, were you surprised to learn that the attacks in Sri Lanka were Islamist-inspired?
Yes, everyone was shocked by the scale and the intensity and horror of it. We knew that there were radical Muslim groups, but previously their violence was directed at other Muslims for not being good enough Muslims. And particularly this group, some part of it which is being blamed for these attacks, was known to attack Sufis in the eastern coast, which is where there are a lot of Muslims. There was, however, a worrying incident in December of last year, which began to sort of shift people's thinking, which was when a group of young men, apparently students of the radical preacher Zahran, who is the leader of National Tawhid Jamaat, who's blamed for the attacks, smashed up some Buddhist and Christian statues. Now, it was a small scale. It was just one town, one incident. But it was the first time that any of these sort of radical Islamist groups had attacked other religions.
For most people who know anything about Sri Lanka, what they've known is that there was a huge civil war between the Sinhalese and the Tamils. One set broadly Buddhist, one set broadly Hindu, but around national and linguistic issues. They didn't really know that there were other significant religious minorities in Sri Lanka.
You're right. That's the broad international framework through which Sri Lanka has been known. And of course, the civil war was intense and 100,000, 150,000 civilians killed over its 25-year period. So there was reason for that to be the focus. But about 3-4 years after the end of the war in 2009, a movement grew up that in the name of defending Buddhism against the threat of radical Islam, a movement involving Buddhist monks began to campaign quite strongly, big rallies in the street, big social media hate campaign against Muslims, and also attacks on Muslim-owned shops, on mosques. There was 2 days of rioting against Muslims in 2014. In March of 2018, some of the same groups following a traffic incident in which a Buddhist had been killed by some Muslims. They used that to sort of fan the flames of anger. They had 4 or 5 days of rioting, burned out hundreds of houses, shops, smashed up, I think, a dozen or more mosques, and a couple of people were killed.
Given that the attacks on Muslims were by people who claim to be defending their Buddhist faith, it seems paradoxical, to say the very least, that the people affected by these attacks, or some of them, should end up attacking Christians.
Precisely because that's sort of counterintuitive, that people are looking elsewhere for these dynamics. I spoke to many Muslim leaders, civil society leaders, politicians, activists, who were worried that at some point the extreme restraint and calm of the Muslim community, which had never hit back at these Buddhist mobs until this incident I just mentioned in December, there was a lot of worry that at some point they would. And there was worry about what would happen then if Buddhists were attacked. So finally, for some serious, you know, Islamist violence directed to other communities to emerge, for it to be Christians, it doesn't make sense within Sri Lankan dynamics. There's been no history of tension between Muslims and Christians in Sri Lanka. So that was the first big indicator that maybe something from outside had infiltrated and a new kind of ideology with a new target was at work.
Has Christianity been an important religious component in Sri Lanka?
Yes, absolutely. There are, say, roughly 6 to 8% of both ethnic communities, Sinhalese and Tamil, who are Catholic. And the Catholic Church plays a disproportionately important role given its size, particularly among Tamils. The Catholic Church played a very important role in the Tamil national struggle, in the struggle against the state, which they saw as Sinhalese dominated during the war.
So the Christians actually had already been kind of targets of some of the Buddhist extremists and now had become the targets of these Islamist extremists. Is that partially because Christianity was associated by both with a colonial past?
That would be part of the issue for the more militant wing of Buddhists. Yes, they think it's part of a long-standing Western domination, Western deterioration of their local culture. But I do think colonialism and the lack of any serious apology for it or engagement with it by Western governments who make comments about Sri Lankan politics all the time but never deal with the colonial legacy, this fuels the sense of anger and the sense of being under siege and having their culture undermined that so many Sinhalese Buddhists feel.
Given that there was already a campaign against Muslims in Sri Lanka, which most of us over here, I think, knew nothing about. Given what has happened now, how is that campaign likely to develop?
Well, that's what a lot of people are worried about. To be honest, a lot of people thought, including myself, that the warnings from Buddhist nationalist groups about the Muslim threat were overblown. And that was partly because they were conflating a lot of different things. Women wearing the abaya and the niqab covering their faces, that was seen as radical extremism that's a threat. The economic power and the political power of Muslims was seen as a threat. A whole bunch of things were seen as threats, which really I don't think were threats. But they will certainly now say, and they will have objective evidence, that there are at least some within the Muslim community who are willing to do acts of horrific violence against other communities. And they will say, there we go. This is the threat. It's still not been dealt with. We need to do something about it. The government will be under intense pressure to do something about it. And what that something is, I think, is worrying. There obviously needs to be much better security and much better understanding of these dynamics within the small number of Muslims who are, you know, engaged in radical activities or tempted by violence. But there also needs to be a lot of work done by political, religious, and civil society leaders of all communities to make sure that Muslims as a whole are not blamed for the actions of a very small number of their community.
Alan Keenan. So now let's broaden it out. How far is what's true of Sri Lanka true of the rest of the world? Getting reliable quantitative evidence on this is always going to be difficult. But for over a decade now, the highly respected Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. has been studying religious restrictions, hostile acts against those of any or a particular religion around the world. So joining me from our Washington, D.C. studio is Alan Cooperman, Director of Religion Research at Pew. Alan, as far as your research can tell, is religious intolerance on the rise around the world?
Oh, David, that's a great question. It's natural, I suppose, to look at the horrific events going on like the Easter bombings in Sri Lanka and the mosque shootings in New Zealand and just assume basically that religious intolerance and violence of all kinds must be rising. But, you know, if you divide events into categories and try to count them consistently and objectively year by year, it isn't necessarily the case that everything is worse. For example, the number of countries fighting religious wars is actually lower than it was a decade ago.
Okay, so let's do some definitions. When you look at what's going on and you're trying to measure this, you use this phrase restrictions on religion. How do you define them?
Well, we begin by dividing into two main types, government restrictions on religion and social hostilities involving religion. So government restrictions are laws or policies or actions by government officials at any level. They can range from, you know, favoring some religious groups with state funding to restricting worship or preaching or conversions. And at kind of at the extreme end, they include state-sanctioned discrimination, expropriation of property, violence against religious groups. Usually, these are targeting religious minorities.
So would you count, I don't know, the enforcement of dress codes in Iran as being such a restriction?
Absolutely. We also count social hostility, which are actions by non-government actors that could be everything from individuals to small groups to large organizations, social movements, or really essentially an entire society that discriminates against, that vandalizes, that causes mob violence, et cetera, against religious individuals or groups on the basis of religion.
So when we look first at social hostilities, do we see a rise over time?
Yes, certainly in some categories you do. For example, you mentioned religious dress codes. The number of countries where women are harassed for violating religious dress codes has risen dramatically in the 10 years that we've been trying to track this. Also, terrorism is up. It isn't so much the number of countries where religiously motivated terrorist groups are active that's risen. That's about the same as it was back in, say, 2007. But the number of terrorist attacks with mass casualties, which we define as 50 or more people killed or injured, has risen dramatically. So just for example, in 2007, we counted only 8 countries where religion-related terror attacks caused 50 or more casualties. And in 2016, we counted 33 countries.
What do we see when we look at government hostilities?
You know, most countries in the world have low or moderate levels of government restrictions. But some of the most populous countries, like India and Pakistan, have either high or very high government restrictions across a whole range of religious activities. And as a result, the majority of the world's population actually lives in places that have high or very high government restrictions.
Which is the most repressive government when it comes to religion?
Ooh, you know, that's tough. It's a little hard to say which is exactly higher than the others. But Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, China, Russia are in that very high category.
Yeah, these are very different sorts of governments, aren't they? Some are very much in favor of a particular religion, and then some, like the Chinese, I imagine, are pretty hostile to most of them.
Yes, exactly. I don't think the comparison should be made directly, and I wouldn't make claims, for example, about which religious group is the most discriminated against or suffers the most violence around the world, because it's really hard to compare.
And yet, in your report, Christianity does seem to be at the top at the moment.
Well, Christians are the world's largest religious group. There are about 2.2 billion Christians in the world. So it's actually not surprising that the Christians are harassed or discriminated against in the largest number of countries. But bear in mind also that in many cases, it's fellow Christians who are doing the harassing or discriminating against smaller Christian groups, let's say against Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses or Baptists or Pentecostals. And if you do this in kind of percentage terms, population, then you'll actually see that some other religious groups like Jews and Muslims and Hindus are more likely to live in countries in which they're discriminated against than Christians are. That when it comes to social hostilities involving religion, very often it is a minority religion and the minority that's targeted is a subgroup. Let's say Ahmadiyya Muslims being targeted by other Muslims, or Shia being targeted by Sunni, or Sunni being targeted by Shia. And this also happens, of course, with Christians and with various other religious groups.
Alan Cooperman. What should we make of what we've heard about Sri Lanka and the evidence from Pew? What do they tell us about religious strife? Joining me in the studio to discuss this further is Karen Armstrong, a religious historian and author of many books, including the forthcoming Lost Art of Scripture. In Gibraltar is Robin Gill, Emeritus Professor on Applied Theology at the University of Kent. And down the line in France is Oliver McTernan, founder of the conflict resolution organisation Forward Thinking. Oliver McTernan, we've heard that according to Pew Research, there's been a recent uptick in religious intolerance around the world. Is that what you think you see?
Yes, I think there is intolerance in general, and where it the fault line is where you have a diversity in religious beliefs. It's not De Seb in itself. The cause of it is religion. It's a complex mix, I think, of grievance, religion, social, political, economic problems.
Now, Karen Armstrong, one of the things that's pointed to when whatever McTernan's just said is the difficulty in unpicking what is religious intolerance, what's due to other factors. Historically, how does what we're seeing now in terms of religious strife compare?
The big difference is that until the modern period, nobody saw religion in a special category of its own. Words that we translate as religion in other languages, such as din in Arabic, signify an entire way of life. Religion permeated everything. It's only in the modern period where you start getting religion and politics and the secular put into separate categories. And part of this process was confining religion to a minor part, and it was also a reaction to the so-called wars of religion and putting religious faith as the catalyst that had made this dreadful violence. So religion gets sort of stuck with this label of violence. We never go to war for a single reason. And terrorists, they're always essentially political.
Robin Gill, is that how you see it?
Yes, I think there's been a bit of a sea change in the time I've been involved as an academic in religious studies. When I first started, the common assumption by my colleagues in the other faculties, well, religion is meaningless and disappearing. By the time I came to retire from the religious studies, it was, oh, religion is dangerous, and unfortunately it's still with us.
And why do you think that was?
Philosophical changes during that period of time was still where language was everything, and religious language didn't make much sense to many philosophers. Now we've moved into a situation post 9/11 when the social realities of some of the religiously inspired violence we've seen in the world was becoming very obvious to everybody.
Take the case of somewhere like Sri Lanka, where you have significant groups with different religions and different ethnicities. How does religion in those sorts of situations act as a mobiliser for intolerance, Oliver McTernan?
I think Sri Lanka is a very good case because we see there a complexity of colonialism. Portuguese first imposing Catholicism, then the Dutch imposing a Calvinism, then the British with a sort of aggressive evangelicalism. This then combined with what I would describe as cultural chauvinism, where you have two main parties thinking that they had a destiny, a claim over the island, economic, political grievances, and again, this demonizing of the opponent. You look at all of these in the Sri Lankan case, and you see that they are and have been playing into the problems that country has faced since independence.
Now, Karen Armstrong, what do you say to the person who, looking at the world recently, says, yes, but the people who carry out these acts of terrorism, their conscious motivation, the reason why they say they do it, is motivated by religion?
Well, I don't think that's true at all. I think if you look at Islamic violence, for example, which is much in the news, one of the main causes that have driven people to warfare or to terrorist actions has been an appalling realization of the suffering of Muslims worldwide. Muslims look at Palestine, for example, and the rest of the world seems uncaring about the suffering of their Palestinian brothers and sisters. The same was true in the Lebanon in the 1980s. And the sense that they wanted to help. And also a real anger that the rest of the world seems totally unconcerned.
But Oliver McTernan, why would they only see the world as uncaring in relation to Muslims when, firstly, and fairly obviously, a significant number of the casualties of the conflicts are caused by Muslims themselves, and secondly, lots of other people are also casualties?
I think that's a very good question, but to, I think, understand what's going on at present, we have to go back to the colonial period, to the mid-17th century, because religion then was used by the European colonizers as an instrument of control. So in order to belong to the elite, you had to convert to whatever denomination the colonizer belonged to. So Westphalia didn't take religion out of international relations.
You'll have to explain Westphalia.
Westphalia was that agreement towards the end of the 17th century that said, let's finish wars over religion. It's not an issue. The religion of the king is the, or the prince is the religion of the state or the country. That was fine for Europe. But then we took that, our differences, to the new colonies. And I think what we are seeing is the sort of roots of difference, discrimination, and it all came to a head, I think, with independence, that there was an imbalance in the societies that we left behind.
Robin Gill, one argument that people are likely to put against the overall thesis that somehow or other religion is not behind all this is that if you look into the writings of the great religions, there's an awful lot of violence in there. And not only that, but some of it appears to be prescriptive. The people are enjoined to actually undertake violence against unbelievers, heretics and infidels.
Yes, and quite a number of the sacred texts, certainly of Judaism, the Quran, the Old Testament for Christians, parts of the Mahabharata for Hindus, what are there are quite clearly texts which, read in one particular way, literally, do seem to enjoin violence. Christians fairly early on realized, and Jews did too, that one can understand that in the context of the time when those texts were written, perhaps. But that doesn't imply that you have to do the same thing now.
Karen Armstrong, your latest book touches on some of this and the way in which people look at scripture. At one level, people seem to be invited to say, here's a word which is transcendent, it comes from a greater authority, and therefore how can we be blamed for suggesting that this is the way in which we should interpret it and play it out?
Well, take the Quran, for example. We have these texts that are quoted by jihadis as well as Islamophobes, which seem to indicate that jihad is mandatory. But for the first four centuries, the leading commentators on scripture said that those texts about warfare, first of all, added up to no single ideology. They were all incidental, but that they were now no longer applicable. They had applied only to the time of the Prophet, when the Muslim community was deeply imperiled and facing extermination. They became popular when Muslims started being attacked in about the 12th century. On one side, you have the Mongols, who took away vast swathes of Muslim territory, and from the Crusaders from the West on the other. And there you start getting these belligerent interpretations of the text. And the same is much happening today.
So, Oliver McTernan, the same thing might apply, as we were listening to earlier, to Sinhalese Buddhists who, for one reason or another, feel attacked by Muslims. They now revert to religious reasons for seeking to, in their view, push back.
I don't think the Sinhalese Muslims or Sinhalese Buddhists see the main threat coming from the Muslim communities. They see the presence of other faiths challenging their perception of the sovereignty, unity of Sri Lanka being rooted in Buddhism. I've spent many hours talking with Buddhist monks in the various monasteries because there is a new sort of activist monk or belligerent monk, I would say, trying to come to terms with how they accommodate their present actions with the fundamental beliefs of Buddhism. And their arguments was that would be in an ideal situation, but in a complex situation as theirs, where they are trying to defend the essence, what they say, of their beliefs, you suspend the bigger ideal and you address the problem, be it with the Tamils, Hindus, Christians or Muslims. You tackle it in a conventional way of dominating and, if needs be, taking life.
But that seems to suggest that the notion of being under attack is less totally defensive than we imagine. But I want to move us on to a slightly separate question, which is raised in the Pew Research, which is the increasing intolerance of governments towards either religion or specific religions. How do we explain that, Robin Gill?
I think my perception is that many governments in the West, at least, have lost some religious literacy. And one of the big surprises to some of the professionals was the Iranian Revolution in 1979. That wasn't supposed to happen. The Shah of Iran had secularized and thought that secularization would sell itself. Scholars in that area, and there were very few of them who had predicted that the Iranian Revolution was going to burst, they said they had become profoundly illiterate at being able to read the religious minds of the people themselves in Iran. And I think there's some truth of that, that the illiteracy of Western intellectuals in terms of religious matters hasn't really helped us to understand what's happening in terms of the resurgence of religiously inspired violence.
Oliver McTernan, what about a country like China, which is responsible for a significant amount of the crackdown on religions that Pew is reporting?
China is fearful that religion could lead to the disintegration of the country as we have it now. And there is some argument from that if you look at what's happened elsewhere in the world. I think the root of the problem is not just a lack of religious literacy among political leadership. Remember, the Enlightenment and what I referred to earlier, the Westphalia Agreement, took religion off the agenda. So a lot of current political leaders have been educated in this way of thinking that religion belongs to the past, it's not a causal factor in people's relationship. Combine that with religious illiteracy within the religious communities themselves. I think a lot of the problem arises from the fact that a lot of believers mistake piety and cultural practices with fundamental beliefs. And there, I think the responsibility lies with the religious leadership itself.
Karen Armstrong, what's the outlook? Because if Oliver McTernan is right that the problem is illiteracy amongst governments and actually religious illiteracy amongst the religious, how on earth can you resolve that?
Very difficult to say. I think it's exacerbated by a strident nationalism, which has surfaced in recent years. Nationalism, as Lord Acton pointed out in the late 19th century, has a fatal flaw, that it cannot deal with minorities. And religious communities don't conform to the secularist norm. This is not seen as coherent with the national spirit.
Oliver McTernan, is the model, which I suppose I was brought up on, which was that there would be all kinds of religions in a particular place, and then a nice, kind, secular state that would hold the ring between them and let everybody worship what they wanted and keep more or less religion out of politics and so on. Is that model completely gone?
I think it was an erroneous model, because for most faith traditions, you cannot separate the political, the social from the religious belief. That belief has to have an expression in the public arena. Religion essentially is about moral values, which express themselves in social values. So there will always be, whatever the faith tradition, that sort of fundamental challenge, you might say, to the status quo, and should be, if religion is understood properly and being practiced properly.
Robin Gill.
I think the universities have a part to play. What we've seen in Sri Lanka is that the young people involved in these acts of terror are often quite educated. They've frequently been to university. So anything that universities can do to put on courses which genuinely educate people in how to understand their religion and other religions and the relations between them, it seems to me, plays a vital part in trying to build a better society.
Professor Robin Gill there with Karen Armstrong and Oliver McTernan. My thanks to them and also to Alan Keenan and Alan Cooperman. We'll be back next Thursday. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Richard Fenton-Smith, Kirstine Knight and Serena Tarling, and the editor was Jasper Corbett. If you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. Try the programme on Huawei.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.